Now back to Weekend Edition.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. It's nearly 2 years since the Hamas attack on Israel that sparked the devastating war in Gaza. We talked to a Palestinian former lawmaker about the impact of the conflict.
How could such crimes happen and continue for 2 years while the world is watching?
Then states start to cut Medicaid. We have the impact. And until recently, South Korea had banned tattoos by non-medical professionals. Now tattoo artists are moving out into the open. It's Sunday, October 5th. News is next.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. Flags fly at half-staff Saturday in Minnesota to honor a wildland firefighter who died in the line of duty last week. 26-year-old Bella Oscarson lived in Floodwood until earlier this year, when she and her partner moved to Idaho, where she worked with the Idaho Department of Lands. Oscarson was struck by a falling tree while assisting with a prescribed burn. She died from her injuries later that day. Oscarson previously served with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources and the Conservation Corps, fighting fires across the country and in Canada. She wrote a children's book about firefighting called The Firebug. According to her obituary, she loved outdoor adventure, cooking and baking, crafting, gardening, and reading, and shared her joy, quiet faith, playful humor, and funky dance moves. Her family asks that memorials be sent to the Wildland Firefighter Foundation. Two private equity funds will take over Minnesota Power. The State Public Utilities Commission unanimously approved the acquisition Friday. The decision wraps over a year of back and forth. The utility's parent company, Elite, says it needs capital to fund the clean energy transition, but opponents worried about the potential negative impacts of private equity business practices. The PUC commissioners say they were initially skeptical of the sale, but numerous stipulations and agreements that they say protect and create benefits for customers made them comfortable giving their approval. Here's Commissioner Audrey Partridge.
Every way I could look at it, this deal is only good for these investors if Minnesota Power does well.
While the PUC will still regulate things like electricity rates and service quality, opponents of the sale worry about its ability to hold two of the largest asset managers in the world accountable. Commissioner Huick Won Hom proposed the decision option that the PUC went with.
You guys develop the record, bring it to us. If there is any misbehavior, we can deal with it.
The sale is expected to close later this year after the PUC issues its written approval. The Black Duck City Council will host its final public hearing Monday to amend its cannabis ordinance. Larissa Donovan has more.
After hearing a presentation from cannabis cultivator and manufacturer Nobo to transform the former Anderson Fabrics manufacturing facility into a cannabis operation in August, Black Duck began amending its ordinance. The factory closed down earlier this year, laying off more than 100 workers. The former plant is next door to Black Duck Head Start, and Black Duck's existing cannabis ordinance placed buffers around schools and daycares for cannabis businesses. The amendment would remove buffer requirements for cannabis manufacturers and cultivators while leaving them in place for cannabis retailers and dispensaries. This change would pave the way for the new business that promises about 150 jobs. The public hearing at 6 p.m. Monday will precede the final reading and potential adoption of the amended ordinance.
Bemidji's nonprofit Animal Rescue has invested significant resources into a new facility for its furry residents. Larissa stopped by Thursday.
Marina Lovell became the executive director of Great River Rescue within the last couple of years, and she immediately hit the ground running with this project, a two-acre fenced-in dog park. She says the goal is to give these shelter dogs, who can stay there for months before adoption, more freedom to roam.
I started the same day as Stormfly. That was December of 23. And, you know, I watched and observed and I felt for a while, and then I figured it out that we needed an area for them, because Stormfly was never going to be able to be off leash because she couldn't hear. It's why she became a stray twice.
Level says with adequate exercise and stimulation, shelter dogs can avoid what's known as kennel stress, which can lead to depression, resource guarding, and more reactive behaviors, all of which can lower their chances of successful adoptions. The public is invited to bring their dogs and see the new play area for Great River Rescue's Halloween walk from 4:30 to 6:30 on October 25th. With a costume contest, photo opportunities, and prizes on the line, costumes are strongly encouraged. Cost is $5 per person, dogs free, with proceeds going toward Great River Rescue. Larissa Donovan, KAXE News.
That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
In addition from NPR News, I'm Aisha Roscoe. The Supreme Court returns to the bench this week, and the justices are scheduled to consider some major issues, including the legality of President Trump's tariffs and important disputes about free speech. And casting a shadow over it all, the new standard the court set last term concerning the scope of presidential power. NPR's Carrie Johnson covers justice and the Supreme Court, and she joins us now. Hi, Carrie.
Hey there.
The case last term that brought about this real widening of presidential power, it was the one about immunity from prosecution. Remind us what the justices said there.
That case revolved around criminal charges that were brought against former and now current President Donald Trump by the special counsel Jack Smith. A conservative majority of the Supreme Court ruled that Trump and future presidents are presumed to be immune from prosecution for their official acts because they need leeway to do their important work. James Burnham worked in the Justice Department in President Trump's first term. He says the whole system is designed to work that way.
Article 2 says, which is the part of the Constitution that talks about the presidency, it says that the executive power shall be vested in the president. And so I think the framers clearly intended, and in fact did, create a very energetic and strong presidency in order to guide our nation.
He says the Supreme Court has multiple justices, Congress has multiple chambers, but the executive branch is really one person, the president.
So fast forward, Donald Trump is now president again. How might that immunity decision or the reasoning behind it look now?
Yeah, I reached out to Steve Loddick. He's a law professor at Georgetown who's been critical of the Supreme Court.
With every day that passes, the Supreme Court's decision in the immunity case looks increasingly, stunningly, myopically naive and really part of a much broader decline of accountability mechanisms, the consequences of which we are reaping in spades.
Vladek says the Supreme Court opinion last year basically left two options to hold a president to account, at the ballot box or in Congress. We're still some ways out from next year's midterm elections, and Congress is not checking what he considers to be excesses by Trump. And one more important point in that immunity decision, it says presidents have absolute control over the Justice Department, including things like prosecutions and investigations. We've seen in the last week or two how President Trump directed the DOJ to hurry up with investigations of some of his political opponents. One of them, the former FBI director Jim Comey, is now fighting two felony charges. Comey says he's innocent and going to go to trial.
The Supreme Court insulated the president from most criminal jeopardy, but what about the people who work for the president?
That's still a bit of an open question since the bulk of last year's immunity decision revolved around the special powers of the president. But the legal experts I interviewed say there are other protections for people inside the government who follow a president's orders. They can rely on opinions from the Justice Department office that interprets the law and can shield federal workers from many prosecutions. And then again, there's always the president's power to pardon, which is absolute.
Looking ahead to this new term at the High Court, what kinds of cases has the court accepted that could further affect presidential power?
One case involves the president's sweeping tariffs. Two others involve the firing of a Democratic commissioner at the Federal Trade Commission and Trump's attempt to fire Lisa Cook on the Federal Reserve Board. There are a few more cases on the emergency docket now that could get a full hearing from the Supreme Court. A White House spokeswoman, Abigail Jackson, says the Supreme Court has consistently upheld the Trump administration's policies despite an unprecedented number of legal challenges. She says the president will continue to carry out the policy agenda the voters elected him to pursue, and that he will be vindicated by higher courts.
NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. Carrie, thank you.
My pleasure.
Hamas says it's ready to release all the remaining hostages, living and dead. Yesterday, the militant group announced it was ready to accept President Trump's proposal for a Gaza ceasefire, but wanted to negotiate some conditions. In the meantime, Israeli bombardment continues in the Strip. Sami Abu Shahadeh is a former Palestinian member of the Israeli parliament and activist. He took us back to what it was like to be Palestinian before the Hamas-led attacks on Israel on October 6, 2023.
Everyone knows that history did not start on the 7th of 2023. Before October 7th, there was Israeli occupation for millions of Palestinian lives. And there was crimes against humanity and against the Palestinian people on a daily basis. All the Palestinians under the Israeli control suffer in different ways. You know, there were a kind of different political regimes. One for Gaza, where 2.2 million people were put under siege in a very, very small place. It was like a big prison. Same with the Palestinian lives in West Bank. You cannot move from one place to the other without passing a checkpoint. I can talk about the Palestinians who live as Israeli citizens. There's a kind of a racist political system. To serve more the Jewish part of the population in all fields of life.
So that was life before October 7th. How would you characterize Palestinians' reactions to October 7th in those first few days after the attacks?
First of all, in my point of view, very big percentage of the Palestinian people were against the attack of civilians. I don't think that any Palestinian leader or activist or politician thought that the Israeli reaction will be so violent and unhuman and might lead to a genocide.
Of course, last month, I will point out a panel attached to the UN declared that Israel is committing a genocide. At this point, how has the war in Gaza changed what it means to be a Palestinian?
I think it changed in every mean of life. It brings you to questions about the humanity. It brings you up very serious to question the international system. How could such crimes happen and continue for 2 years while the world is watching? It's a genocide happening online.
Do you feel like Palestinians have been heartened by those who have protested in support of Palestinians?
Yeah, we highly appreciate all the great people. They are the people who are keeping up some humanity. But in the same time, when you are seeing states sending weapons for Israel in order to kill us, or you see Trump's blind support for Israel and its policies. It takes you to a totally different way of thinking. It's very complicated.
And what is the state of Palestinian leadership today?
What happened lately in the last few days with this new deal of Trump and Netanyahu is simply racist, ugly, and very humiliating. To go and talk about a solution while the Palestinians do not exist at all. Our leadership did not exist in the solution while we are the main victim of what's happening here now. As a Palestinian leader, I must say that we did not do enough to save our people in Gaza or to save our people in the West Bank. If we were organized in a better way, we could have done much better.
I mean, I want to acknowledge, because it's big that you're saying, as someone who is a leader and has been a leader, you feel like more could have been done by Palestinian leadership. How so?
Well, I think the main issue here is that the Palestinian leadership was not unified against all these war crimes. The fight between Hamas and Fatah has prevented all of the Palestinian different factions to join forces, stop this war, and open a new horizon for the new generation.
And of course, Fatah is the main Palestinian political party in the West Bank. Given the deep divide between both sides today, what can actually be accomplished for Palestinians?
In this current balance of power, we cannot do much. We should tell our people the truth, and we should tell the people that it's going to be a marathon. It's not going to be a short run. In order to go out from this vicious circles of violence, revenge, or blood, we must have a solution for Palestinians and Israelis. The current situation within the Israeli political system, the choices that they are offering us, is either a genocide or an apartheid. And we will never accept our inferiority in our homeland. Like the rest of the people, we're not asking for anything strange or anything big. We are just asking to live like all other human beings.
I thank you for talking to me. I thank you for your candor. That's former politician and Palestinian activist Sami Abu Shahadeh. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to NPR News.
You are listening to Weekend Edition here on member-supported radio, KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. KAXE started without federal funding in 1976, and today, nearly 50 years later, we find ourselves in the same place again. It's a powerful reminder that this station has always been people-powered, and today, that need is even greater. Join us at KAXE.org. Pay nothing to get that old or damaged car towed away, even if it doesn't run. Your donation of a car, boat, or other vehicle is tax deductible. You save time and money while defending the KAXE programs you love. Call 855-277-2346 for details. The Arrowhead Library System presents They Brought Their Songs, International Folk Music in Minnesota, with musical trio Kaylee, October 7th through November 5th. Find a full list of dates, times, and locations at als.info. Now back to Weekend Edition.
I'm Jaleel Snyder with these headlines. President Trump will be in Norfolk, Virginia this afternoon to help celebrate the U.S. Navy's 250th anniversary. In a post on social media, Trump said in all caps that the show must go on, and he again blamed Democrats for the government shutdown that's now in its fifth day. A federal judge in Oregon has temporarily blocked the Trump administration from deploying National Guard troops in Portland and in Chicago. Details on a potential Guard deployment remain unclear, although the White House this weekend confirmed plans to send 300 guard troops to the city. And former NFL quarterback and Fox Sports analyst Mark Sanchez has been charged with multiple misdemeanors. Police say he was involved in a fight last night in downtown Indianapolis that left him hospitalized with stab wounds. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. We're in a federal government shutdown over affordable care tax credits. Meanwhile, state governments are starting to make cuts to their Medicaid programs. That's the public health insurance covering more than 70 million Americans. Those cuts are likely to continue regardless of how the shutdown ends. Here to tell us more is Bram Sable-Smith. He's a reporter with our partner KFF Health News. Bram, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
For those who might not be familiar with the benefit, can you briefly tell us what Medicaid usually pays for?
So Medicaid is a joint program between the feds and the states. We usually think of it as covering adults and kids with lower incomes, but it also pays for longer-term services like in-home care for people with disabilities and also nursing home care. 3 in 5 nursing home residents in the U.S. rely on Medicaid. So it's a large program. It typically makes up around 19% of the spending from any given state's general fund. And many states are facing budget shortfalls, and they're looking to slash their Medicaid programs to make do.
These programs are pretty tightly funded to start with, right? So, I mean, what is there to slash?
Right. Well, so far this year, 2 states have forced every medical provider that accepts Medicaid to take a pay cut. So Idaho announced a 4% across-the-board pay cut in September. And most recently, North Carolina on Wednesday cut pay by at least 3%. Primary care got an 8% cut, and specialty care saw a 10% cut.
That sounds like a lot. I mean, what effect do those pay cuts have on people's access to health care?
Well, when you cut payments to doctors and to nurses and to physical therapists, they become less likely to accept patients that have Medicaid coverage.
Okay. So is that already happening in states that cut payments?
Yes, it is. I spoke recently to Alessandra Fabrello. She lives in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and she's a medical caregiver for her son, Isidor, who's now 18. He experienced a rare brain condition as a baby that kills brain tissue, and he's needed round-the-clock care ever since.
He struggles to survive every single day. It is almost impossible to explain what it takes to keep a child alive who should be dead.
Medicaid is supposed to pay for him to get that care at home. Otherwise, he'd have to live in a hospital. But even before this rate cut, Alessandra said it's been extremely difficult finding in-home medical providers who take Medicaid. Take physical therapy, for example.
He doesn't receive any therapy. He qualifies for therapy, but he doesn't receive any in-home therapy because we cannot find providers because of the reimbursement rate as it is.
Medicaid already paid way less than private insurance, so not many providers take it. And now with these new cuts, even more providers are dropping out. And for the past year, North Carolina's Medicaid program paid Alessandra herself to take care of Isidor. It's her main source of income. And now she's facing a pay cut, too.
Are we going to see cuts like this in other states across the country?
Well, we don't know yet what other states plan to do, but these cuts in North Carolina and in Idaho really could be an indication of things to come elsewhere. There's sort of a perfect storm brewing right now. State budgets are getting squeezed. Medicaid costs are going up. Some states are cutting taxes. Federal COVID relief dollars that states were using to patch budget holes in the past fully dried up this year. And of course, President Trump's signature budget legislation is going to cut federal spending on Medicaid by almost $1 trillion over the next decade. States will have to make that up or cut services. These provider pay cuts are an example of how states will begin to manage those shortfalls.
Well, we will continue monitoring the situation, as I'm sure you will too. That's Bram Sable-Smith. He's a reporter with our partner KFF Health News. Thanks so much for your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
The U.S. territory of Guam is home to two major military bases. Now, thousands of Marines are arriving to a new base there. The goal is to strengthen the U.S. presence in the Pacific with an eye to China. But as Nina Rao reports, locals there are feeling some side effects.
Plastic cutlery clinks against styrofoam plates as a group of Guam veterans gather around a cooler. They share red rice, fina denny, and barbecued chicken, staples of Chamorro cooking. Chamorros are the indigenous people of Guam, and most of the veterans here tonight are Chamorro. They've come for Battle Buddy Talk, a weekly meetup for mental health support. But tonight, the conversation is about something specific.
What veterans think of the buildup? To some people, it's been a godsend because it created some jobs. To others, it maybe created some problems.
That's Roy Gamboa, a veteran facilitating the conversation. The buildup he's talking about is military. It was announced in 2006 when the U.S. and Japan agreed to move an estimated 5,000 Marines from Okinawa to Guam. Approximately 100 of them have already been moved. The rest are expected in the next several years. But it's not just Marines. Many others have moved to the island already to support the buildup, like missile defense teams, civilian contractors, and construction crews. That influx is tightening an already stretched rental market, according to real estate experts. And Gamboa says it's making housing harder for longtime island residents to afford.
How many people have friends or family members that are veterans that relocated because it was just too expensive on Guam?
All 30 people raised their hands. Robert Underwood is chair of the Pacific Center for Island Security, a research institute that provides analysis of military strategy anchored in the perspective of islanders. He says since the buildup was first announced, it's taken on a new purpose, countering China's growing influence.
The United States military has assumed that there's going to be conflict with China down the road. And this is where the military planners have said they're going to draw the line on China. Guam is the only place that can't say no.
Because Guam is a U.S. territory, not a state. It doesn't have voting representation in Congress. That makes it very different from places like Hawaii, where senators and representatives could vote against federal spending on military projects they don't like or attach conditions to their approval. People here can't vote for the president.
I oppose the U.S. military buildup to Guam because we don't get to say yes or no.
Michael Bavacqua is a Chamorro activist and cultural historian with Independent Guahan, a group that advocates for Guam's independence.
We lack that fundamental sovereignty.
In response, Rear Admiral Brett Midas, who's commander of the Department of Defense installation in the Mariana Islands, including Guam, says local leadership is always kept in the loop on everything that's happening with the buildup.
We don't ever go more than about 90 days without sitting down with the governor and her team and talking about where we are. I think for them, the most important thing is just to know what's coming and then to be able to partner on how we're going to tackle those challenges.
Housing is getting more expensive on Guam for a lot of the same reasons it's getting more expensive in the continental U.S. Strong demand, limited supply, inflation. The military buildup is part of that strong demand, but Guam housing experts say the situation here is worsened by land limitations on an island and the high cost of importing construction materials. Military personnel receive an overseas housing allowance, which starts at $2,200 a month. So they can afford to pay the rising cost of housing here. But lots of locals can't, like Tori Manley. She's 29, Chamorro, born and raised in central Guam. She's a contract worker at the National Park Service, That pays her $19 an hour. Until a few years ago, she lived in a multi-generational household with 10 people sharing two bedrooms.
I had a full-time job, I went to school, and then it was too cramped for me to really stay in the house.
Sometimes she chose to sleep in her car just to find some space. She now lives in a two-bedroom fixer-upper with her boyfriend and two roommates. They pay $400 a month.
There's two bathrooms, but only one works. And then, of course, there are some electrical issues, but if the rent is that low, then it's okay.
Admiral Midas with the Department of Defense says the military is aware that bringing more people in raises housing costs. He says they're still figuring out their strategy to accommodate all of the new personnel expected to move here.
We could just build new military construction, but it costs a lot of money. Or we could partner with local businesses in the local community to be able to find creative options.
He didn't provide specific examples, but said there may be developments on Guam that aren't full all the time, or where developers hadn't been able to finish their work and the government could help fund it to completion. They're currently taking bids for these projects. For some people on Guam, the military's expansion has been positive, like local business owner Jim Pinson, who owns GMI Scuba Wholesale, a diving equipment store.
Our real tourism market right now is the military and the contractors. They're the ones that are keeping the hotels full. They're the ones that are keeping most of the dive shops going.
The Guam Department of Labor estimates that tourism accounted for about 6% of Guam's GDP in 2024. Federal spending was over 40% of the GDP in 2022, including defense and non-defense, according to the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis.
All I want to do is make enough money to pay the bills, have a little extra money, and keep going.
But a lot of people are conflicted. They see the good and the bad at the same time. Like Rora Gamboa, back at Battle Buddy Talk, who says that another good thing about the buildup is the security it provides Guam.
Unfortunately, you know, it hurts. The prices go up. Yes, it does. But there's that, everybody talks about that price of freedom.
He says the island is a target, being so close to China. And he's glad that the U.S. is building up the means to defend it. For NPR News, I'm Naina Rao in Guam.
What's the oldest piece of clothing in your closet? Maybe a hand-me-down hat, a jacket from your high school football days. How about a 675-year-old shoe?
Pues es una sandalia que se ha mantenido.
It's a sandal made of grass rope that has been kept in great condition. It's as if it's been preserved in a time capsule in a well-protected closet.
Antoni Margalida is an ecologist with the Spanish National Research Council. That time capsule he mentioned is the nest of a bearded vulture, high in the mountains of southern Spain. For more than a decade, Margalida and other researchers have been studying the nest of these endangered raptors. In a recent study published in the journal Ecology, they uncovered a surprising trait about the bird. It's an incredible collector, an archiver of things made by humans.
Se fueron encontrando restos antiguos de la sandalia, una punta de flecha.
We found remains of an old sandal, the tip of an old spear, and a piece of painted leather. We were not expecting to see them in such good conditions.
The vultures built their nest inside mountain caves, and generations of the birds reuse the nest, sometimes for hundreds of years. The high-up caves are perfect for keeping baby birds safe, and the stable temperature and humidity inside preserves things like shoes and bits of cloth, likely used to build the nest.
Pues han sido como un museo natural, y cuando datamos.
It's like nature's museum, and when we dated some of the objects, we could see they were from the 13th century. That was very surprising.
But most of what they found in the nest were bits of bone. Bearded vultures are scavengers, and bones make up most of their diet. In Spanish, they're called quebrantahuesos. It means bone breakers. They were mercilessly hunted to extinction in much of Europe. The Spanish government even paid people to hunt them up until the 1950s. Margalida says studying the bird's abandoned nest can teach us about ecology and human history.
Everything we have found will provide us with a picture of human customs of that era. The biology is also very interesting. What did the species eat? Where did it raise its young?
Margalita says the biggest challenge so far isn't finding the nest or rappelling down mountainsides to the remote caves. It's getting funding. Bone breakers are maybe not the most charismatic wild animals. But Margalita hopes that with all the attention this latest study is getting, there'll be more appreciation for Europe's most endangered vulture. You're listening to Week in Edition from NPR News. Years ago, Gilmore Girls premiered. The show followed a young mom and her teen daughter and the quirky residents of their small Connecticut town, Stars Hollow. Fans still flock to the area that inspired the show, and Connecticut Public's Cassandra Basler went with some of them.
The town of New Milford in the leafy hills of northwest Connecticut looks like the set of Stars Hollow. White steeples, a town green, a gazebo. It even hosts a Weekend in the Life fan festival.
Our moms heard about the event, and it's also just because we both love Gilmore Girls and we watched it together.
I met 11-year-old best friends Abby Thorgerson and Riley Nicolette dressed up in prep school uniforms to match the main character, Rory Gilmore.
I would say I've seen it like 15 times, like from start to finish.
I finished it like once. But I keep, like, watching, like, some, like, multiple episodes.
Gilmore Girls ran for 7 seasons and a 2016 revival on Netflix. And over the past few years, the show has seen a surge in streaming in the fall. Viewers embrace the cozy, small-town feel and the community that basically raised young mom Lorelai and her teenage daughter, Rory.
You don't have to take us all the way to Luke's.
Yes, Kirk, listen to her.
I offered you the first ride. And Kirk's new Stars Hollow pedicab, and that is exactly what you're going to get.
Okay.
But there's some debate about which Connecticut town can call itself the real Stars Hollow. I met fan Shauna Tobins shopping for show merch in New Milford.
This is it, right here.
Okay. New Milford is the real Stars Hollow.
Yep. All right. It is.
Tobins and her daughter Angelina came to the festival all the way from Ohio. They made a week of it, including a visit to Yale, the university that Rory Gilmore attends.
We haven't been to Washington. Is it Washington Depot?
That's where show creator Amy Sherman Palladino stayed when she got the inspiration to write Gilmore Girls. At a busy diner, she saw a customer go behind the counter to pour themselves a coffee. And she took notes. That's something Lorelai does on the show all the time.
We're running out of coffee.
Yeah, I'll make some more.
No, I got it.
Michelle Gora says her town definitely embraces that lore. She's the economic development coordinator for the town of Washington.
So it doesn't exactly look like the Gilmore Girls, but the people, the characters, the way we operate. We still have town meetings. We still vote for our town budget with a show of hands.
All those in favor of Stars Hollow taking a swift kick to the tush and shouldering the entire cost. Okay, well, motion carried.
That, I think, is the part that she really captured well.
And across the way at the Washington Food Market, which looks a lot like Dozie's Market on the show, owner Lisa Stein wants to set the record straight. She says Washington is Stars Hollow.
And I do live in New Milford, so, you know, I get, you know, that. But this is definitely a Stars Hollow. It's not the same. I mean, it's a lot smaller of a town, more tight-knit.
And Stein says this tight-knit community embraces the giddy Gilmore Girls fans, too. For NPR News, I'm Cassandra Basler in Hartford.
To hear more about how Gilmore Girls shaped generations of fans and how Connecticut shaped the show, check out Generation Gilmore Girls from Connecticut Public. Visit ctpublic.org/Gilmore to subscribe. This is NPR News.
You are tuned in to Weekend Edition here on KAXE, KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Local businesses, you can help defend the future of KAXE and keep People Powered Radio on the air with your sponsorship dollars. Visit kaxe.org/give to learn about sponsorship options. A big thank you to all our current business sponsors. There will be a candlelight vigil at Angel of Hope Park in Grand Rapids, Monday, October 6th. Those grieving the loss of a child, no matter what age, and supporters will gather for a brief ceremony at 6 p.m. The park is located on the south bank of the Mississippi River, two blocks off Pokegama Avenue. There will be refreshments and music at River Grand following the vigil. Fire in the Village hosts the Creative Crow Club the first Wednesday of each month from 4 to 6 at Old Central School in Grand Rapids. Youth can explore their artistic gifts, find their voice, and build a caring community. Now back to Weekend Edition.
I'm Joel Snyder with these headlines. With Israel and Hamas seeming to move forward on the Trump administration's proposed peace plan for Gaza, Special Envoy Steve Witkoff is leading an American delegation to Egypt for indirect talks tomorrow on the president's proposal. There is no ceasefire yet. Israeli military strikes continue to hit Gaza. In southern China, hundreds of thousands were evacuated ahead of today's landfall of a strong typhoon. Flights in the region have been canceled, and authorities have shut down public transportation. Many businesses are closed. And the ruling party of the former Soviet Republic of Georgia is claiming victory in this weekend's local elections, despite a boycott by the opposition and a huge protest in the capital that led to clashes with riot police. I'm Joel Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, telling stories behind data and trends that shape our world today through its podcast, After the Fact. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Gen Z-led protests are making waves from Asia to Africa. The issues driving them vary from place to place. One commonality, though, is a symbol on flags, shirts, and posters. Kate Bartlett brings us this look at a piece of protest anime.
It was there when young people, angry with the lavish lifestyles of the elite, brought down Nepal's government. And again this month, as Madagascan youth march against chronic water and electricity shortages. It's being waved now at protests raging over poor healthcare in Morocco, a grinning skull and crossbones, wearing a straw hat. The flag comes from this Japanese anime and manga series called One Piece, about a ragtag band of pirates, dubbed the Straw Hats, fighting an oppressive world government. It's become a global pop culture phenomenon, translated into multiple languages, and now a Netflix series.
It's about a group of misfits, outsiders, rebels, people who do not fit in the system, coming together under a shared flag, not to dominate, but to live freely and chase justice on their own terms.
That's Nurianti Jali, an academic with Singapore's Yusof Ishak Institute who studies subcultures.
Young people who feel unheard by their government, who feel trapped in unfair systems, immediately recognize themselves in that story.
Like this 23-year-old Nepali, who joined last month's protests.
The Straw Hat Pirates symbolize freedom, liberty, the spirit that you have to oppose the unjust authority. That really inspired me. And we decided to raise it along with us.
And this 25-year-old protester from Madagascar.
It resonates with the Gen Z's protests around the world because the Gen Z's are trying to take down the corrupt system. It shows a parallel between the reality and the fiction.
Neither protester wanted to share their names for fear of government retribution. Andrea Horbinski is an expert on modern Japan and manga who lives in the Bay Area.
When people bring the Straw Hat flag in particular to a protest, they're signifying in solidarity with other protesters in other countries who have recently famously flown the flag themselves.
The Jolly Roger isn't the only pop culture symbol in protests. Hong Kong demonstrators reclaimed Pepe the Frog. Myanmar protesters, the three-finger salute from the Hunger Games, and in the US, some No King signs referenced Andor. But for the Gen Z youth right now, the anime flag embodies a spirit no politician can match. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
A breakup devastated Welsh artist Kate Laban.
I think I'd been trying to outrun heartache and convincing myself I was doing a pretty good job, but I was really just carrying it around with me.
So she poured it into her music. The new album, Michelangelo Dying, later today on All Things Considered. Tune in on your radio or tell your smart speaker to play NPR. We're surrounded these days by the products of Korea. K-pop on playlists, demon hunters on movie screens, even Korean barbecue on dinner plates. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports on another cultural export that's gone global, one that was only recently illegal in South Korea.
Tattoo artist Kim Do-yoon, who goes by the artistic name of Doi, prepares for a customer in his Seoul studio. He inks images of people and animals that seem to float above the skin, with shadows beneath them. He tattoos fine threads that drape over arms and shoulders. Some images are shaded with dots like grainy photographs. Doi has inked celebrities, including actor Brad Pitt. Like other Korean artists, Doi's fame has spread via social media.
When Korean tattoo artists flocked to Instagram, they created a big new wave in the global tattoo industry. But we didn't get to benefit from it. We could have developed the culture further and enjoyed it, but we missed the opportunity.
Doi uses light touches of his needle to tattoo a blue flower on the right forearm of client Eric Sohn. Sohn has a tattoo of his pet dog on his left arm.
As I grew older, I thought about what I wanted to do, what had given me the most joy, and it was getting a tattoo. But it was difficult to search only for something that's personally meaningful. Then I saw Doi's artworks, and this design caught my eye.
Doi founded a tattooist's union and has campaigned to legalize tattooing in South Korea. For the past 33 years, tattooing by non-medical personnel was punishable by up to 5 years in jail and a fine up to the equivalent of about $35,000. South Korea's parliament changed that last month. The new Tattooist Act will take effect after a 2-year grace period. The act says that the tattooists must be trained, pass an exam, and get a license. Several years ago, Doi himself was fined after a video of him tattooing a famous actress went viral and someone reported him to the police. But Doi is happy to get the free publicity and he's pleased with the new law.
I still randomly burst into laughter because I'm so, so happy.
Not everyone shares his glee. Korean Medical Association, or KMA, policy director Lee Jae-man told a press briefing in August that legalizing non-medical tattoos could threaten more than people's lives and health.
The popularization of tattoos can encourage impulsive tattooing among minors, driven by curiosity or trends, which can lead to educational and social problems.
But an estimated 70% of tattoos in South Korea are not artistic, they're cosmetic. And that, Doi argues, is why the KMA opposes non-medical tattoos.
Dermatologists and plastic surgeons have made a fortune from eyeline and eyebrow tattoos. The KMA can't help but protect their interests by saying as a group that tattooing is a medical practice.
But the stigma around tattoos is not just about medical risk. In pre-modern Korea, Japan, and China, criminals were punished by being tattooed on their faces. Modern-day gangsters get inked to show identity and loyalty to their gang. Doi continues his work. He says that 70% of his clients are women. They tend to like small, delicate tattoos with personal meaning. Doi says each of his artworks is a collaboration with an inspiration shared by inker and inked. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
Motherhood can be a beautiful thing, but it can also drive a person to the brink and right over it. In a new movie, If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, we meet Linda, a mother drowning in anxiety. Her young daughter, an off-camera vortex of need, is suffering from a mysterious illness for which Linda blames herself. She has a stressful job as a therapist. And when an epic plumbing mishap blows a massive hole in the ceiling of her home, flooding her floors, pushing her and her daughter into a dingy motel, Linda's left to handle it on her own because her husband, who is away working, is little more than an unhelpful voice over the phone. It's a lot. The film stars Rose Byrne, Conan O'Brien, A$AP Rocky, and Mary Bronstein. Mary Bronstein also wrote and directed the film, and she joins us now from our studio in New York City. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
I gotta ask you, like, how was the making of this movie? Because watching it, it is so anxiety-inducing. Mm-hmm. And as a mother, I mean, it felt like a day in the life in some respects.
Oh, wow. I love to hear that. We made the movie in 27 days. Oh. It was not a luxurious situation. And I'm a filmmaker who believes that the tougher the material, the more pleasant the set has to be. Because if I'm asking my performers to really go there, to get into that place emotionally, then when I call cut, it's got to be hugs and giggles. Yeah. Because otherwise, it's not going to work. It's not going to work.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the thing about this is, because this is a movie about a mother who is trying to do everything for her daughter. And then she's dealing with roof caving in and all this other stuff. And so much of the movie, like you just see shots of Linda's face. Like you just see her. Was that a choice to highlight Linda's loneliness?
I was using it for a couple reasons. One, to show her pure isolation. She's a woman who is going through it. She has this child that has a mysterious illness. She's displaced from her home, and she has all these other stressors. So I'm using the close-up to highlight the isolation and also to really say to the audience, I'm putting you in this woman's reality, and that's the only reality that you have. We can't reality check against her. We have to radically accept what she's experiencing.
And you know, I mean, I think there is this part of motherhood. I mean, people will say that you can lose your identity in motherhood, but I also think it's this idea of there's so many pieces that you have to deal with because she's still working. She's not. There's that joke where they keep, you know, calling her a housewife. She's not a housewife.
She's not a housewife. She's a working mom.
She's a working mom. She's dealing with the house. She's basically kind of a married single mother because the husband is away. And he away, so she on her own.
You get it so completely. And the idea of, I know you relate to this, we are trying so hard, as you said, the needs that are being asked of us constantly is a bottomless pit.
It's relentless.
It's relentless. Because there is this thing in our society where we hold mothers up to this lofty ideal thing, the mother.
Yeah.
Then that perfect mother that we compare ourselves against, she doesn't exist.
Yes.
It's a myth.
What do you think this movie tells the audience about the experience of motherhood?
The challenge that I have found in my experience of motherhood and that I'm trying to get at in the film, the person that you were before you became a mother, that person doesn't disappear once you give birth or adopt a baby or however you do become a mother. Where does that person go? And how do you balance keeping that person alive? I started writing this movie out of a real existential crisis that I was having about that issue, where I felt myself disappearing into the task at hand with my own daughter. And I started writing the movie to kind of try to figure it out and kind of save myself a little bit.
You know, I felt like the scene, to me, that was really kind of pivotal. And it was when Linda, she's in this group session that she has to do as a part of dealing with her child's illness. And there are these other moms. And you, Mary Bronstein, you played a doctor who leads the group. And I got to say, I didn't like you that much because from Linda's perspective, I was feeling, because we're seeing Linda's perspective of you. And Linda's perspective of you was like...
Absolutely. Dr. Spring is the Gestapo.
Yes. We have a clip.
So as parents, a lot of times we look too closely at ourselves and we start to ask ourselves, is this my fault? But all that does is create a thinking trap.
You keep telling us that it isn't our fault.
Yeah.
But it is.
Excuse me?
I mean, if it isn't our fault, then we're really super... We're just walking around pretending we have power to change something that we don't even understand because it's not our fault, but we know how to change it even though it's not our fault.
Oh, man.
Oh, man. But here's the thing. You know, as the therapist, you're telling the mothers not to blame themselves. But
yes,
as a mother, it's like there is a pressure to fix it.
I'm playing the doctor who's really taking her to task. Why aren't you listening to me? Why aren't you following my directions? Why aren't you working this program? When I'm writing it, I am with Linda too, because that's a confusion that I have where it's like, yeah, it's always told it's not your fault. Okay, it's not my fault. But then I'm also the one that's supposed to know everything, to always know the right thing to do for my child. But guess what? Sometimes I don't know. And if it's not my fault, then how am I supposed to know how to fix it? And I have in another scene where she's talking to her therapist and she's literally begging him, tell me what to do. Yeah. And his answer quite frustratingly is, well, you already know what to do. And it's like, no, I don't. No, I don't. That's not what she needs. Yeah. What she really needs is somebody that's saying, you know what? What you're going through is hard. And that's what she is looking for and begging for. And nobody is giving that to her.
The stakes are so high. You need to allow that everything won't be perfect. I'm not going to make all the right decisions. But
kindness,
I understand. Yes.
A kindness to yourself. Where is the room to forgive ourselves for some of these transgressions that we make during the day and during the years that we're raising our child?
I mean, because I guess, you know, we're talking about this as mothers, but people will watch this movie who are not parents. What do you say to those who will be coming to this movie? They have not had these experiences. What can they take from this?
Everybody has been through an experience where they feel like the universe is conspiring against them, where they feel like they have a load on their shoulders that isn't fair. And that whole thing of like, you know, we're not ever given something that we can't handle, that's not true. Sometimes we cannot handle it. And we need to have kindness and forgiveness and empathy. And the other thing is, you're watching this movie, you're in this woman's reality. It's an empathy test at that point then. Mm-hmm. How can you find empathy for her in this situation? And how far does that stretch?
That's Mary Bronstein. Her new movie, If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, is in select theaters this week and nationwide October 24th. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was wonderful.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where visitors can unwind on white sand beaches and dine at restaurants. More at visitspc.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, telling stories behind data and trends that shape our world today through its podcast, After the Fact. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
Mm-hmm.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from Bemidji Symphony Orchestra, presenting Sky Tinted Water, celebrating the 50th anniversary of Voyageurs National Park, Saturday, October 4th at 7 p.m. at the Bemidji High School Auditorium. Dr. Beverly Everett conducts. Tickets available at bemidjisymphony.org. The Buck Lake Improvement Club has a spooktacular breakfast buffet Sunday, October 12th from 9 to noon at the Buck Lake Community Center.